The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
This is a story about how the world's most powerful, richest country is slowly losing its influence.
And it's evident here.
We can see across Brazil, thousands of Ford cars almost disappear.
Meanwhile, China's BYD is becoming increasingly common.
Ford left a plant abandoned. BYD, they modernized the plant. They are now producing electric cars from Brazil.
It's evidence of the growing connection between Brazil and China, the B and the C of the BRICS Plus coalition. This is a group that hopes to rival the US-led G7.
The most important emerging economies in the world are the four BRICS: Brazil, Russia, India, and China.
My fellow Americans, this is Liberation Day.
This mantra,
America first,
has created an opening.
The trade war increased the solidarity between BRICS nations. The BRICS are now emerging as really the only global forum that can stand up to Trump's trade war.
I think the president, and you put your finger on it, is going through a change here dealing with Putin. He's completely frustrated by him. He knows he's been, you know, president very smart. He knows when somebody's gaming him, but he thought it was worth stringing it out a little bit to see if he can move him in the right direction. He knows that's not going to happen now.
German Chancellor Friedrich Merz touched on the largest strike on Ukraine in Wednesday's general debate in the German parliament, promising renewed aid for Kyiv. He also said that he has no hope left for a diplomatic solution to the conflict.
We will continue to help Ukraine, even against the resistance of the political left and the Russia-friendly right here in the House. We will continue this support. And let me make it even clearer. The means of diplomacy have been exhausted.
Well, he is making clear that those phone conversations with Vladimir Putin have not yielded results. It's also in the vein of the latest comments that we've seen from U.S. President Donald Trump.
It's easy to focus primarily on Israel and Israel's relationship with the United States and all the wars going on in the Middle East, especially when you're here and you're broadcasting live from Jerusalem. But as you can see there in that cold open, I mean, we're living in a world, an entire world that is in turmoil, a dangerous, perilous time, as Paul said. And you don't need to look very hard to figure out, as I said on a show a week or two ago, that this is certainly not God's world, as the Apostle Paul stated in 2 Corinthians. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily, coming to you live from Jerusalem for the last time. We have to leave, sadly, we have to leave tomorrow. All good things come to an end. But we've had a busy several days here in Israel. We've had an interview Monday afternoon. We played some of that for you yesterday on the show. And then we'll finish off with Michael Oren today, the rest of the interview that you didn't see on yesterday's program. But in the aftermath of that, we saw an Israeli commentator named Gadi Taub, most of you probably aren't familiar with him, although he's very popular here in Israel. And it was a great interview with him yesterday, and we're going to be playing that for you tomorrow on the show. And then Friday, we have Melanie Phillips lined up. We spent the afternoon at her apartment, took all of our gear in there, and we also had lunch with her. So some fascinating discussions coming up on the rest of the shows for this week. Melanie, we actually have a short clip of her that we'll play a little bit later on to whet your appetite. But we talked about the hostages that President Trump and Bibi Netanyahu are trying to work out a deal to get them released, and the ceasefire and the strike on Iran, and just all kinds of things to discuss, and that we ended up spending more time with her than we did even the other two. So going back to the cold open, an interesting opening segment from Bloomberg, talking about how all of the tariffs, and the United States is, you know, they're already bragging about generating $300 billion this year in tariffs or funding from tariffs. And yet, as we've continually been saying, you have to look at the way the world is reacting to this, the way that the world is responding to this. We've told you over and again about the Mart of Nations, and that's what we see forming. You have the BRICS nations, as you just heard there. They're growing, and they're growing fast, and they're using their influence together in opposition to the United States. We're seeing a world in realignment. Listen to this. This is another one from that Bloomberg report, number two.
Four members joined in 2024, and this year Indonesia joined as well. So now there are 10 countries.
10 countries equals economic power. Look at how the original BRICS have grown compared to the G7 in terms of global GDP since 2009. It surpassed the G7 in 2019. Now add in the expanded lineup and its share is nearly 40%.
In terms of GDP by purchasing parity, it has overtaken the G7 countries. The trajectory is clear. BRICS countries are growing faster. Their populations are growing as well, for most of them.
This boom in population and wealth has also given the group more political might, which in turn has made more countries interested in joining. BRICS has even talked about a common currency.
Overall, BRICS countries support reduced trade in US dollar as a tool, as a method to reduce overall Western economic dominance in the global economy.
They want to dominate. China has wanted to dominate. We've talked to all the commentators we talked to this week have commented on the mindset that you see in Iran or with Hamas, and just how difficult it is to actually work out a solution to make peace. Because you have all of the nations in the world competing. Herbert Armstrong used to talk about the way of get. That's the whole system that we see in every nation. And more, it's just every nation for itself. And they're looking for allies. Prime Minister Netanyahu, he's over in the United States this week. He had a meeting on Monday night. And then again, last night, a second one that wasn't even planned originally. And they really want, as you heard from the Trump people, they really wanted to hammer out a Gaza ceasefire deal that would include the release of some of those hostages. And there's about 50 of them still there, not all of them alive. But Israel desperately wants those hostages released. And there's quite a movement here in this country saying, bring them home now, no matter the cost. The Jerusalem Post this morning, their editorial board came out and basically got behind the movement. Look, you've got to come home with a deal. They want a deal too, just like Donald Trump. And Prime Minister Netanyahu, he's under quite a lot of pressure to not only get the hostages back, but to crush Hamas. And from Hamas's standpoint, they're saying, if you want the hostages back, Israel has to surrender. We win. We stay intact. This is from that Jerusalem Post editorial. It's from the editorial board. So this is now the newspaper's position. It says, Prime Minister Netanyahu flew to the U.S. earlier this week as reports and statements by President Donald Trump indicated that a Gaza hostage and ceasefire deal may happen this week. And the Post board says, any option that isn't a deal is inexcusable. You have to work a deal. It says here, prioritizing hostages over Hamas. It talks about two polls from a while back where it says Israelis, a majority of them, prioritize getting the hostages home over a complete victory over Hamas. So there's a sentiment now, a growing sentiment, evidently, if we're to believe the polls, that says, okay, we're not as concerned anymore about complete victory or total surrender on the part of Hamas. Now it's more about just getting the hostages home. We brought this up with Melanie Phillips earlier today. As I say, this will whet your appetite for the full-length interview. Actually, it's probably going to go into two shows that we'll start with on Friday. But for now, listen to what she says about the hostage exchanges that Israel's been engaged in recent years. Clip 7.
I do think that, you know, the hostage issue has been unforgivably weaponized here in Israel by the left. The left has one objective only, to bring down Netanyahu. Whether or not you support Netanyahu is not the issue. You may think he's dreadful. To use the hostages, to use their relatives, and what those relatives have been going through is unthinkable. To use that terrible distress, these vulnerable people, in order to weaponize the fate of the hostages against Netanyahu and to blame him, therefore, for not bringing them home, and to say there's blood on his hands because he's not brought them home. The price of bringing them home is Israel's surrender. That's been made absolutely clear by Hamas from the start. You want the hostages back? Fine. You surrender. We remain in power. We remain here. You guarantee not to come after us. You guarantee to stop the war. You guarantee everything for us. And then they come home. In other words, total surrender. So what Netanyahu is being asked to do is to sacrifice the lives and security of 10 million people for what was originally 240.
You talk about lopsided numbers. We're familiar with giving them 1,500 Palestinian terrorists in exchange for, what, 4, 5, 6 Israelis? But what about exchanging the security for 10 million Israelis, for 50, or as she said, 240-ish that were taken originally? I mean, she said in our interview just how complicated the world is. And that's really a nice way of putting it. It's a nice way of saying that this is not God's world. You see evidence of Satan in so many regions. Well, all of them, really. They hate and want to bring down Bibi Netanyahu, the radical left. They're more concerned about that than they are about Israel's safety. And they're weaponizing the hostage issue. Bring them home now. You see the banners all over Tel Aviv. We were in Tel Aviv the last two afternoons. This JP article says, at present, the rumored talks of a 60-day truce for a series of hostage releases. In other words, you stop firing, Israel, you surrender, and we'll give you some hostages. We'll give you maybe 10 of them back. And Israel, I mean, she at one point, she talked about the original truce right when President Trump came into office this second term. And just what a disaster the ceasefire was that time around. And of course, Israel didn't even get the hostages back that were promised by Hamas. And so here we are with round two. This time, a 60-day ceasefire. It says here, the goal of destroying Hamas is broad, flexible, and can be changed based on security and political needs. The hostages, on the other hand, are stuck in a deteriorating state of hell. That's more pressing, says the Jerusalem Post. Striking Iran as hard as we did, landing blows to Hezbollah that it has never experienced, crippling Hamas in Gaza, all this is not worth it if Israeli citizens can't trust the government enough to be sure that if their family and friends were to be kidnapped by a terrorist group, it would bring them home alive. It says here 50 families are experiencing this agony, this grief. Further on it writes, the damages that this social discord and trust would bring cannot be overstated. What is the point of striking Iran as we did if the social contract is hanging by a thread? What exactly is there to protect if not that? Not just land, but the trust of the people. And then one final paragraph, it says, this starts with taking responsibility and being honest. If there's no deal, stop dragging your feet and say it like it is. 50 hostages remain in Hamas captivity in Gaza, and no regional win can overshadow that. If there is, do not leave Washington and Doha without it. Time and excuses from all parties involved has run out. So, and if the reports are true, I know a lot of the conversations last night between Bibi and President Trump weren't made public, but evidently we got a paragraph on this in the morning brief, but evidently there was no, you know, last minute deal worked out. And then you've got the negotiators over in Doha as well, and they can't hammer out a deal to get those hostages released. You look around the world, you look at here in Israel, as Melanie Phillips brought out, they hate Netanyahu so much they want to destroy him. I mean, that's what takes precedent. And then they weaponize the hostage situation to carry out their political aims. We talked earlier this week, by the way, about Bibi Netanyahu nominating President Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize. And this caught Trump by surprise, as you heard on one of the shows earlier this week. And Molly Hemingway, I thought she had an interesting take on this. She doesn't know if maybe that's the best way for Donald Trump to even get the Peace Prize because of how much hatred there is for Benjamin Netanyahu. Listen to clip 6.
I'm not sure there's anyone who could do more harm to the cause of, not that you actually care about getting a Nobel Peace Prize given who they give it to, but
right,
Bibi Netanyahu is not the person who's gonna help deliver it to Donald Trump. I don't think they hate him probably even more than they hate Donald Trump.
It is such a joke. I mean, for the people who have won, it's like the Pulitzer Prize. Like, seriously, like all the bogus reporting that was done on Donald Trump along the way.
That Nobel Committee, they hate, the only person they hate more than Trump is Netanyahu. And when we were talking to Gadi Taub yesterday, he talked about Bibi derangement syndrome. And he said, in some ways, I think it's stronger here than Trump derangement syndrome is in the United States. And in both countries, I mean, it just highlights the hatred and the division, the strife that there is internally. I think it was in Michael Oren's interview where I'm getting them all kind of where they overlap. But he was talking about, I asked Melanie Phillips, I'm not sure if I asked Gadi this, but basically, why was Israel caught asleep at the wheel on October 7th. How did this happen? And Melanie Phillips, by the way, had some fascinating comments on that, which you can look forward to on Friday. But one of the things that Mr. Oren brought out was the fact that there was just so much bitter division internally. It weakens nations, this kind of internal animosity and hatred. And so you see nations not just looking out for themselves, You see within, and this is primarily in the Israelite nations. Again, you can go to Mr. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, to understand our identity. But we see so much division internally as well. Jesse Waters had a segment last night talking about the Democrats, how they're regrouping and preparing, basically, for violence. Clip 5.
Democrats are acting like it's do or die, and they're on a warpath. A Democrat running for city council in San Antonio just took out a hit. Quote, I want to see a few dead ICE agents in Los Angeles. Don't let me down. Radicals are already answering his call. A New York man was just arrested for threatening to murder an ICE agent and his kids. After an ICE sting in Virginia, he says this, I can't wait to put a bullet into this guy's brain. But first, his children. Assaults on ICE agents are already up 700%. And Democrats want it to get even worse. Over 24 hours ago, a gunman opened fire on a Border Patrol facility in Texas. The Justice Department calls it an organized tactical ambush. And Bondi's crew just hit these wannabe assassins hard.
Today, my office has charged 10 individuals with 3 counts of attempted murder of a federal officer. It was a planned ambush with the intent to kill ICE corrections officers. Make no mistake, this was not a so-called peaceful protest. It was indeed an ambush.
We have the mugshots. Look at that. Big surprise. 2 of them are trans.
What a world. Here they're, these agents, they're trying to remove people who enter the United States illegally. And you've got radical, hardcore leftist protesters carrying out some peaceful violence again. It's all about power to these people. And they'll do anything, even violent acts. They're calling for it. They're inciting it. In the case of Jew hatred, as we've covered, I mean, here they're singing about killing the Jews. And that's happening in Britain. Here again, Melanie Phillips had a lot to say about the spread of radical Islamism in Britain as well. And then you look at the mayoral race in New York City. How is this happening? Would other nations tolerate this kind of division and strife internally? It seems like the Israelite nations are, I guess, quite okay with it. Now, Mr. Netanyahu seems pretty optimistic that reality will set in and overwhelm this radical leftist worldview that causes so much trouble and even violence at home. But your Bible gives us insight as to how all this plays out in the lead up to Jesus Christ's return to this earth. There have been all these reports this week about the FBI launching criminal investigations into John Brennan, James Comey, for all of the fake, phony investigations into Donald Trump years ago, Russiagate. It was all a hoax, and they knew it, and they lied about it. And yet at this stage, it feels almost like it's just theater, that it's just all for show. You've got the cover-up of the Epstein files now, and then when they say, well, we're looking into Brennan and Comey, you wonder if that will just disappear at some point as well, because no one's held to account. Melanie Phillips was talking about the security breach in October, or October 7th, 2023, and how that there were warnings that were just dismissed by the higher-ups, and a lot of it was political. Hatred for Netanyahu, trust in Israel's enemies. And then you have October 7 play out. Miranda Devine, ex-CIA chief John Brennan may have opened himself up to perjury or perjury charges at the Federalist. Brennan's fake Russia collusion assessment even more corrupt than current report shows. According to Breitbart News, members of Congress and senior staff maintain that Brennan had testified behind closed doors that he did not advocate for the dossier to be included in the ICA. That testimony, however, conflicts with the findings, from the newly released CIA review. So yet another investigation exposing more corruption. But will anyone be held to account? I mean, how can you eliminate this kind of division, or in the case of, you know, illegal immigration, how can you eliminate this kind of lawlessness if you don't have law and order, if you don't enforce the law? We'll see how it plays out. But this, and then you look at Israel's deep state. We talked a lot about this with Gadi Taub, about how, and again, a pretty close parallel to what we've experienced in the United States. Lawfare, using lawfare to try to bring down Netanyahu's government. So that's that. We have to leave enough time to finish off the Michael Oren interview. Don't forget, we've got Gadi Taub. I think you're going to be really excited to hear what he has to say tomorrow, even if you're unfamiliar with him. And then, of course, you know about Melanie Phillips. She's been on the show before. She's actually visited our headquarters campus in Oklahoma. So that'll be coming up on Friday. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
One third of your Bible is prophecy, and 90% of it is for our time today. This is why, when you study Bible prophecy, you often read statements like, in that day, in the last days, and at the time of the end. Biblical prophecy is what makes the Bible so relevant to today, so essential to understanding our modern world. Most people, even in the world of religion, assume that nations like Britain, America, Germany, Russia, and China are not mentioned in Bible prophecy. But if prophecy is mainly for our time today, how could the Bible ignore some of the most powerful and prominent nations of today? The key to understanding prophecy is knowing the biblical identities of modern nations. Learn about these identities in Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. In this book, you will learn about the astonishing identity of the American and British people in biblical prophecies. Request your free copy today. The United States and Britain in Prophecy.
What did you make of the following October 7th? Yeah. There were some astute commentators that said the sympathy for Israel will maybe last a few hours, maybe a day.
That was me. Well, I said 3 weeks.
Yeah.
I said 3 weeks.
So
it was very difficult because I went on Israeli television and everyone's kind of saying, the whole world was with us. The whole world was with us. I said, guys, look at your watches. 3 weeks. I was off by about a week and a half with the British.
Right.
The British were about a week and a half. We had a grace period. And I knew it would end.
Yeah. Well, even when they were carrying out the attack, the terrorists were celebrating. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the one guy who called home and
right.
said, I've killed 10 Jews with my own hands. And, mm-hmm. you know, he was so proud of it. But it's almost like you see that same attitude in the ones taking to the streets in Britain, in some cases the United States, in a lot of Western nations, and they're cheering for this. And then, you know, Israel has to fight that narrative, the propaganda that, you know, you're blowing up hospitals right. or whatever else. You kind of alluded to history. I mean, is there just something different? You talked about the difference in Israel's thinking not being, you know, predictable or being too predictable, I guess you said. But just given the reaction, I mean, for me, it was shocking
yeah.
to see people in London or wherever actually showing
American
support.
Campuses, 60 American campuses. It's a product of two factors. One is just old anti-Semitism. And, you know, the British government, before the Iran part of this war, the British government had sanctioned two of our very right-wing ministers. And I go on the BBC and I said to the BBC, I said, you know, I don't agree with these ministers. And a lot of what they do repulses me. But your decision by the British government is anti-democratic, it's anti-British, and it's anti-Semitic. Anti-democratic, obviously, because these people were elected. I mean, you're not sanctioning other despotic regimes in the world, totalitarian regimes. You're sanctioning democratically elected leaders of a fellow democracy. Two, anti-British, because we're fighting the same people who are trying to take you down. You know, Hamas wins here. Guess what's going to happen in the streets of London? But why was it anti-Semitic? Anti-Semitic because the British government singled out the state of Israel. They didn't put sanctions on China. The Chinese government that's put a million Muslims in concentration camp. They don't sanction Turkey or Qatar who support terror. They don't do that. They choose the one Jewish state in the world to sanction. And by definition, singling Jews out is anti-Semitic. And so much of the vehement criticism of Israel, whether it's in the Western press or on these campuses in the United States, was typical anti-Semitic tropes just out of the Middle Ages. I mean, the accusation is that we're committing genocide or we're getting up and we're committing war crimes. You ever ask yourself, well, why is it that the state of Israel does this? Their answer has to be there's something inherently evil about this country. They have inherently evil about the people who inhabit this country. We wake up in the morning and we want to kill children. Wake up in the morning, we want to kill innocent people. That's right out of the blood libels of the Middle Ages, right out of it. Still there, very, very powerful. So that's one reason. And latent anti-Semitism was a great Irishman, Conor Cruz O'Brien, who said famously that anti-Semitism is a light sleeper. And this woke it up. The second reason, and I think it's even a more profound reason, is the same people who are accusing us of genocide, of war crimes, calling for our elimination as a state, they hate their own society. They hate their own people. They hate America. They burn American flags. Listen to what they're saying. They're calling for the overthrow of Western civilization. They're overcalling for the United States in the same route. And they've been educated to think this way. They've been educated to think this way by the universities, particularly if they're coming out of the elite universities. And they've been educated to think this way by social media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And do you feel like, again, going back to negotiating with these people when that that thinking is so strong, I guess, you know, just from where I come from on my podcast, I just say, how do you even talk to them? How do you sit down with them?
You don't, in most cases.
Yeah.
Now, for Jews, that's a problem because the Jewish method for fighting anti-Semitism for decades was sort of three-pronged. One is you expose them, you shame them, and then you educate them. But that didn't work anymore because these people didn't have to be exposed. They were out in the street. They weren't ashamed. They were proud.
Yeah.
And thirdly, they couldn't be reeducated. So you got to think, you got to sort of really change your thinking about how to deal with this. And it was a real sort of trauma, especially for these organizations that have that had made this. This was their goal, was to fight anti-Semitism. Very, very difficult. But the problem here, I think, is deeper. It has to do with, you know, who thinks their civilization, the country, is worth fighting for. One of the terrific, truly extraordinary achievements of this country is that in the course of this war, starting on October 7th, 2023, roughly 400,000 Israelis went out, picked up a gun, and went out to fight, knowing full well that they could all come home in a radically different way, or not come home at all, left their families, left their jobs. 400,000 people, in proportionally speaking, would be about 25 million Americans. That's about 8 or 9 million Americans more than fought in all of World War II. And you want to say to yourself, okay, where in the world does this happen? Well, who's willing to pick up a gun and fight for Belgium today? Who's willing to go out and pick up a gun and even fight for Italy, Spain? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But nothing like this. So in many ways, we're the Western country par excellence. We are willing to fight. We have a population here that's willing to fight.
Mm-hmm.
We have an elite that's very loyal.
Yeah, and you have, as you wrote recently, you have a leader who's the right man for the job. I think I forget how you said, there's leaders in history and then there's...
Leaders of history. Well, Netanyahu feels that he was born for this moment.
Right.
And that's not, you don't always have that. I don't know if Joe Biden thought he was born for the moment to be a transformative president, but I think Obama did. But having a loyal elite is a big advantage. If I can go into this, you know, I'm a graduate of these elite universities. I taught at these elite universities. And some of these universities have walls that have are inscribed with the names of every graduate that died in America's wars, going back to the French and Indian War, the 1750s, the Revolution, War of 1812, Civil War, World War I, World War II, long lists. Then all of a sudden, starting around Korea, the lists start getting real short. By the time you hit Vietnam, it's shorter. And after Vietnam, almost really nothing, nothing, nothing. And there was a time when the graduates of these universities had that sort of a noblesse oblige. They came out and said, listen, I owe something to the society. I'm going to go out and fight for the society. Mm-hmm. You know, the last great representative of that was George Bush Sr., who was a fighter pilot, Navy pilot in World War II.
Yeah.
Graduate of Yale.
Even the Operation Rising Lion, taken out of the Book of Numbers, and then when the Prime Minister made his statement after the so-called 12-day war, he referred to a proverb about wise counsel that was guiding this operation. And I was making a point recently that, you know, it is unusual just to hear a world leader that's referencing, you know,
Bible
passages, because I don't think Bibi is ultra religious, but that's Israel's history, and you know, they're talked about in the Bible as having a lion-like spirit. You kind of have touched on just the changing mentality over the years, like with America, for example. We last week was the 49th anniversary of the Entebbe rescue mission. What would you say is, I mean, you've lived in Israel for how long?
I certainly sort of came to Israel repeatedly before Entebbe and after Entebbe, and I moved to several years after it.
Okay. What differences are there from that 49 years ago to the mentality you're talking about among Israelis today?
So there's a sea of difference, and in certain ways there's absolutely no difference. So what's the sea of difference? I came to a country that was a backwater. It was a lower middle class backwater. Our biggest export item was orange juice. And very isolated. We didn't have relations with China. We didn't have relations with what was called the Soviet bloc, which was 12 countries plus Russia. We didn't have relations with India. We didn't have relations with Africa. We didn't have peace with Egypt. We didn't have peace with Jordan. We didn't have certainly peace with the Abraham Accord countries. Isolated. We had a nice relationship with the United States. We didn't have a strategic alliance with the United States. And there were 3 million Jews who were trapped behind the Soviet Union, trapped behind the Iron Curtain, couldn't get out. So very, very different place. So see a difference. I mean, just we weren't the high-tech giant we are today, and every Jew in the world is free today. And we have these relations, and these relations are strained right now, but no one's breaking off relations with us, almost nobody. And we, with the United States, we have one of the deepest bilateral strategic alliance which the United States has had with any country in the post-World War II period. And we have peace with the countries. If you ever told me I was going to have peace with these countries in the 1970s, I would have told you, you know, you're crazy, you're really crazy. So that has changed. Very different country. You know, become much more materialistic, a more, you know, big social divide between rich and poor that we didn't have back then. But what I thought had changed, and myself and so many other people were wrong when it changed. We thought that this new generation, what they call the TikTok generation, that they were soft and they were selfish, right? And they wouldn't sacrifice. And we were completely wrong. As much as Yoni Netanyahu and his commanders went off to the free the hostages at Entebbe on July 4th, 1976, just an entire generation of young Israelis went out to fight and are still fighting. And I didn't know if they had it in them. But they had them in them much, much more than I ever imagined. So this is the same. This generation is probably the greatest generation we've had since our founding. And well, my father landed on Normandy. He was part of that greatest generation. But this is our greatest generation.
The October 7 massacre has been called Israel's 9/11 by certain commentators.
Sure.
And then when you mentioned the numbers, 400,000 soldiers and what that would be in America, yeah. It's, you know, the carnage was many times over 9/11.
It was 14 times, if you want to know.
Yeah.
Exactly. 14 times 9/11.
But that it took that, like, because America, you know, our reaction to 9/11 was pretty active and intense as well, going into, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq and And now, you know, you fast forward 20 some years and you know, this administration really wants to, you know, get rid of the forever wars, as he calls them, and not get engaged abroad. Don't you think that, you know, October 7, yes, the fighting spirit is still there, but I guess my thinking is what it took for that to be aroused.
Sure.
And the fact that leading up to it, there was, you know, as I said,
what President Eisenhower used to call the wrath of an aroused democracy, right? And we're an aroused democracy. The big difference between the United States and Israel, and there are many differences, you know, the pretext for going into Iraq, many people thought that the Bush administration had misled them. Afghanistan, it wasn't clear what the goal was. Was it to rebuild Afghanistan and turn it to an American-style democracy, a country that, you know, that couldn't happen. But the big difference is that Iraq and Afghanistan were many, many thousands of miles away from the United States. Mm-hmm. I'm talking to you now a 50-minute drive from Gaza.
Yeah.
Where you're sitting has been under fire repeatedly, not just since October 7th, but even before that, for years. Running in and out of our bomb shelter, which is in the room next door. This is all intensely personal up close.
Right.
As close as you can get. And it's not like we had a choice. It's not had a choice. The equivalent would the comparison would be not just 9/11, but if after in the aftermath of 9/11, jihadists had streamed into American homes and farms and communities and beheaded and raped and burnt and eviscerated and took captives, what would America's response have been then?
Mm-hmm.
Not just to send the American army in somewhere. You would have flattened a couple countries, like flattened them.
Yeah. What do you, going back to Bibi being the right man for the job, there's the big negotiations going on this week. On what points do you feel like he is willing? He's already, you could say, he's already stood up to President Trump in a couple of key areas, one that infuriated the president. But what specific areas do you feel like he would part ways with President Trump?
Very difficult. You know, President Biden, and I worked with Joe Biden for years and had a very good relationship with him and a high opinion of him. But he didn't project strength, neither personal nor national. And he said don't. Remember, he said don't?
Right.
He said don't, and everybody did. We did. We did. He said, don't go into Rafah, go into Lebanon. We did.
Right.
The Palestinians, too, did. The Iranians did. Hezbollah did. Everyone did. This president says, don't. And I haven't seen anybody do yet. Maybe Putin a bit. Maybe Putin. And I think that, you know, we don't have the same type of latitude that we had under previous presidents. And I think that Netanyahu is going to think many, many times before going against the will of Donald Trump, many times. And he's going to try his best to stay on the same page. At the end of the day, we are both sovereign countries. The United States is a big, big country. It's far away from the Middle East. It's not threatened with immediate annihilation. We're a small country. We are threatened with annihilation. We're in Iran's backyard. And our interests, as much as we may try, cannot always be consonant, cannot always dovetail. And sometimes we have to take our own actions. Now, you know, you take a president like Ronald Reagan, who was tremendously pro-Israel. Prime Minister Menachem Begin had to make a decision to blow up the Iraqi nuclear reactor in 1981. Right? Reagan didn't like that. He actually stopped up sales of deliveries of fighter jets to us for a while and condemned us in the Security Council. Sometimes we just, you know, we got to take matters in our own hands because they're matters of paramount national security. You know, that. I mean, ultimately, I mean, that reactor would have threatened the United States in Baghdad. They didn't know that back in 1981. They weren't thinking 1991. So we did a huge favor to the United States. But I think in this case, there's a very strong, strong case to be made that Iran threatens not just Israel, but threatens the United States in a very fundamental way.
So you, President Trump, you mentioned him saying don't, and that it carries more weight. On the other hand, he has, on a number of occasions, said, do. And like he said, the hostages are going to come home on day one of the inauguration. He said the Ukraine war would, you know, end.
No, Putin has defied him.
Okay. So, but do you feel like that together with, I mean, he wants to be a peacemaker,
He does.
And sometimes it seems like he wants to make peace no matter the cost. I mean, do you feel like there's Israelis that say, you know, if you're wanting everything to be, you know, quick and easy, you know, drop a few bombs and then go back home? I guess what I'm asking is, if you're kind of telegraphing the fact that you do not want a foreign war or a forever war, that it kind of handcuffs you to some degree when you are in the midst of all those negotiations.
I mean, handcuff Israel or handcuff the United States, or both?
Yeah.
Well certainly. Yeah. The reason that the United States was incapable of containing the Iranian project, which was the takeover of the Middle East, and maintaining a nuclear threshold capability and threatening to destroy us and exporting terror, was because the United States never had a serious military threat on the table. And the Iranians knew it. That Obama had a military threat on the table, but nobody ever thought he was going to use it, except for people in the United States who feared it. His slogan was, it's either diplomacy or war, which was a total false dichotomy. First of all, because the Iranians have zero ability to make war against the United States. They don't have an air force. They barely have a navy. They certainly have no tank corps. It's not going to make war against the United States. But the only reason that it would succeed, if diplomacy was backed up by real power. And I don't get me started, because I think soft power is an oxymoron. I can't take the term soft power. But they're unwilling to do this. This president has been willing to use power, and I think that will greatly strengthen his hands in negotiations. But he's got to keep that option on the table, because if the Iranians internalize that there's no more military option, they won't compromise. Why should they? Yeah. Why should they? And think about it from their perspective. From an Israeli perspective, you know, we, like any other American ally, have an interest in having a United States that is strong, that is willing to project power, and let me say very frankly, that is feared in the world. We're respected and feared. And here you could be talking to somebody from Germany, from South Korea, from Japan, they'll tell you exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
I've gone even further. I say I'd rather have a president who is critical of the state of Israel, but willing to project power, like George Bush Sr. That'd be better than have a president who wakes up in the morning and sings our national anthem, the Hatikva, but is unwilling to project power. We're better off with a tough president.
Yeah.
And I hope that that Donald Trump will continue to be that tough president.
Yeah. You've referred to Obama a few times. I mean, you were ambassador during his first term. What would you say were his greatest weaknesses as a U.S. president?
Okay, his worldview. So, you know, I'll plug this book, Ally. I have the most controversial part of this book. This is my memoir. It's about my life, but also my time in Washington. I did a study in the chapter in the book called Obama 101, where I read everything he ever written, every interview he ever gave, every speech he ever gave, really sat down and like a historian and figured out, okay, who is this person? Because remember, when he was elected president, he'd been in the Senate for 2 years. Nobody knew who he was. And I got a very clear idea of who he was, but also because I had spent a lot of time at American campuses, and his worldview was right out of a campus. And I could predict with 95% plus accuracy what he was going to do, because I knew that worldview. And what was the worldview? I'll give you the short version of it. Great reluctance to use military power. Discomfort with it. It didn't come naturally. A great reverence for international institutions. A belief in internationalism, the UN and other institutions. A critical view of the United States. A country that had, you know, committed X number of crimes in its history. And I'm not talking about slavery and foreign policy as well. An obsession, I must say, with the Palestinians, truly an obsession. You can't imagine the amount of time that the Obama administration devoted to the Palestinians, but you know, ignored the massacre of a half million Syrians, right? And massacres going on all over the world. And that was that worldview. And you know, that, to me, everyone in the Middle East knew it. So, for example, I quoted these Palestinians I worked with who didn't respect Obama because he didn't stand by his allies. I also knew, as being involved in the first stages of what became known as the Abraham Accords, that Obama had set out to bring Jews or Israelis and Arabs closer in peace. And he succeeded.
in bringing us closer, just not through peace. He brought us closer through common opposition to his policies. The glue of the Abraham Accords, we'd like to think it's really high tech, it's very nice. But what really brought us together was America's, on one hand, appeasement of Iran and America's refusal to reject power. And our Arab friends would look at the situation and said, well, there's only one country that's standing up to our two mortal enemies, which is Sunni extremism and Shiite extremism. There's only one country. And that was us. I also thought during this war that one of the reasons we had to win the war so they could win the peace, because countries, Arab countries, Muslim countries, would make peace with us if we showed that we're willing to stand up and beat Sunni extremism, Hamas, and Shiite extremism, Hezbollah in Iran. And we've done that. And I think we're going to get peace because of that. It is. John Lennon, forgive me, but you got to give war a chance.
I'm curious what you think about just the future. The dust has settled on and there may be a ceasefire in Gaza. The dust has settled on the attack in Iran. What is your hope?
Oh, so my hope is, again, that this inflection point will point in the direction of peace, that Iran will continue to be deterred. Who knows, there may be an internal upheaval within Iran. I hope there will be. Lebanon will be free, Syria will be free. We can engage in types of peace processes with both these countries. Yes, our hostages will be released, that Gaza will no longer threaten us, that maybe there'll be a brighter future for the Palestinians as well. We can do that. We can be magnanimous in that way. And then Israel's going to have to start dealing with our internal schisms, because that's what, in many ways, was led to the war. The Hamas understood that we were divided and they could attack us. We have to address that.
Right.
And we have to begin to rebuild our relations in the world, because support for this country around the world, including in some of our closest friends, including the United States, has been seriously eroded. And we have to start rebuilding that. And I view that as part of my job in the future, is rebuilding those foreign relations.
Yeah. What future do you see for Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, as I've said repeatedly, it's always premature to eulogize him politically. I think he's very strong right now. And, I've worked with prime ministers, I've worked with presidents, and I will tell you without reservation, being the prime minister of Israel is simply the hardest job on the planet. There's no weekends, there's no golf vacations and, Nantucket or wherever, Martha's Vineyard. You don't do that. You don't sleep. And not everyone can do it physically. Not everybody can do it intellectually and be a communicator and be a politician. And there's just not many people like Benjamin Netanyahu. For all of his flaws, some of my best friends have, suffered what I call from BB derangement, which is not that much different than Trump arrangement. If there's bad weather outside, it's because of BB, literally. But even they admit now that he is not just a difficult act to follow. He's almost right now an impossible act to follow. And as an historian, I would tell you that history remembers leaders in a way that different than they're seen by their contemporaries. Look, Lincoln was ridiculed, and Truman was ridiculed, really, especially Truman. Oh my God! And today they're remembered as some of the finest American presidents, certainly Lincoln. And that's how we remembered, maybe in a different way, by history. But one thing I'll guarantee you, he'll be remembered.
Mm-hmm. How do you think President Trump will be remembered?
I'm going to give you an answer that Chinese leader Zhou Enlai gave to Henry Kissinger in 1972. Kissinger asked him, do you think the French Revolution was successful? And Zhou said, I don't know, it's too early. So it's too early. We have to see. I think President Trump will be remembered by the Jewish people, because we have the greatest and longest memory of any people on earth. We're going to remember King Cyrus for recognizing Israeli sovereignty of the Golan, for recognizing Jerusalem as our capital, for forging the Abraham Accords, for pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal. Like, there's a long list there. He will be remembered for a very long time. And 100, 200 years ago, now maybe 1,000 years from now, Jewish students will be learning about a gentleman named Donald Trump, who was a great friend to our people.
Michael Lauren, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it.